My name is Karen Blomquist, and the title of this session is What's Different About Being Middle Class, or About Being Working Class? And what I'd like to do is begin by reading a typical stereotype of what working class, or in a more narrow sense, blue-collar folks are like. Now, listen closely to this stereotype. I think it is a fairly degrading stereotype, and yet I think it is the kind of stereotype that those of us who do not see ourselves as blue-collar or working-class folks often have of those folks. In this stereotype, blue-collar men are rednecks, bigots, racists, and fanatics. And under their hard hats lies the great American desert, as one writer has described it. They work at jobs that pay too much, have too little benefits, and too much union protection. They drink too much, carouse too much, fight too much, and chase too many women. They wear cowboy boots on their feet and caterpillar hats in their heads, and their beer bellies hang out over big buckled belts whose capacity to hold up sagging pants defies scientific understanding. They spend their lives working, watching sports on TV, and hanging out in honky-tonks. In this stereotype, blue-collar women are called basically wives or the wife. They are caught up in the home, isolated from the world, and take care of a brood of kids. They wear the fashionable hairdos of 5 and 10 years ago. If they are young and pretty, they are narcissistic and mindless. If they are older, they are brassy and have leathered skin that makes them look hard. Around the house, their hair is in curlers, which provide the crown for a house coat that looks cheap because it's too pretentious. They work in low-paying factory jobs where their mascara and polish on artificial nails are shrill incongruities with work aprons and the production line. The stereotype is all too pervasive. I think that's part of the difficulty, is we have these stereotypes built up through the Archie Bunker kind of stereotype and all the rest, and therefore getting inside and really understanding what can at times be the pathos as well as the joy of working class experience in this country is something we often have not done, even if we ourselves come from backgrounds like that. Let me begin or move on and share with you a description that I developed of a typical urban working class neighborhood. Rows of modest little homes are mostly owner-occupied and well-kept, with their aluminum siding and plastic trim in colors set off from their neighbors. Inside the well-trimmed yard, flowers grow, occasionally interspersed with garish religious statuary, patriotic flags, or ornamentation imitative of far more expensive homes. If it is the summer evening, occupants sit on their front steps, chatting with and calling to one another while the community's youngsters play ball in whatever space is available, perhaps even the street. The husbands sit inside before the TV set with their cans of beer and occasionally yell out commands or even obscenities to their wives or buddies who are outside. The people's lives revolve around this community. It provides them with their sense of who they are and of what they value. Now, rather than thinking of themselves as working class, I think the far more common designation in our society is that tendency for folks to identify themselves as, quote, working folks, unquote. I think the reason for that is because of the pervasive assumption in the United States that we are a classless society, a society in which everyone has reason to hope, to move upward, and therefore designations or a consciousness of class has generally been less clear-cut than in European societies. Most working class persons in this country strive in one way or another to be seen as middle class in their values and material culture. So some would say there really isn't that much difference. There's maybe slight differences, but there's a kind of continuity between being working class and middle class. The difficulty is that middle class becomes this very embracive term that seems to sweep up everyone, and we ignore some of the very real painful differences that do manifest themselves and play themselves out in some ways that really do lead to some deep kind of wounding in terms of people's identity and sense of self-worth. Now, those who are, so what I'm saying is those who would not feel comfortable identifying themselves as working class do tend to think of themselves as working folks. Which it seems to me indicates that there is a reality that is shared in common. Something which I would identify as a class-based reality. Classism is a very real phenomena in our society. You know, we talk about sexism, we talk about racism, but it seems as though we have often overlooked the extent to which class differences lead to a kind of classism. Those ways that we identify and separate ourselves from others, especially according to the criteria of whether or not one has made enough of oneself. Class differences basically rooted in the kind of work that one does or the kind of work that one's family does, but differences that become manifest and generalized in a whole host of other arenas of life, in terms of language, culture, family values, the whole gamut of life. Class is one of the crucial factors defining how we see the world, our place in it, and how we respond to it. Whether one actually is employed in a working class job is not as crucial as whether one identifies with the values, the ethos, and the ideologies characteristic of working folks' reality. And on that basis, we can say that retired folks, family, their family, the family of working class folks, the children, are likely to be shaped by this reality a generation or two after the household head has held a working class job. It seems in our day we could also widen that and say that to a large degree we need to think of working, of farm folks as being a part of those who are the working folks in this country. We've long romanticized them as working for themselves, but I think they too are an increasing part of the phenomena I'm wanting to identify here. So the emphasis is on that positive virtue of working. Work is seen as the route to dignity by making something of oneself. Working folks have a clear sense of demarcation between themselves and those who don't work, who on the one hand might be the permanently unemployed or, quote, the riffraff of society, or on the other hand, those who already have dignity because their jobs involve less menial labor, more independence, more creativity, more social status. And therefore, from a working class perspective, those folks don't really appear to work in the working class sense of work. You know, they're dealing with their minds and, you know, they're not involved in the same kind of drudgery kind of tasks that are characteristic of working class jobs. As one laborer observed, and I think this is the distinction that emerges here is important. He says, when you have a job where there's some call for planning, some call for figuring things out, you feel you're in a different class from the fellow who handles things, unquote. And therefore, there is that very real sense of being aware of one's difference from professionals, from the pastor, for example, even if that professional has a background that is working class. It seems as though one of the aspects of becoming a professional, if one comes from a working class background, is a process of being educated away from the language codes, the values, the basic life orientation that has been characteristic of working class in this society. So let me say something about how this became an issue for me. During the years that I was a parish pastor in California and especially in New York, I became aware of the fact that at a number of times there was a real communication gap between the kind of language that I would use as an educated product of the seminary and the kind of way in which people in my congregation interpreted their reality and their life. And that kind of bothered me after a while. I kind of said, hey, what's really going on here? While I was in New York, I picked up a book called Worlds of Pain by Lillian Rubin and another book called Hidden Injuries of Class by Sennett and Cobb. And all of a sudden, some things began to click for me. And I realized the degree to which I, like so many other people, particularly professional types, had bought into that rather denigrating stereotype that I shared with you in the beginning. And therefore, even though we might be for all kinds of other groups in our society, we have not that sympathetically understood the real plight for survival and the real struggle for dignity of working class folks in this society. And so I began to explore that and to ask more and more questions. And as I did that, one of the important steps in that process was coming to grips with the fact that there was a lot of working class stuff going on in my own upbringing. And all of a sudden, I realized that in this class society, part of the process I had gone through during college and then seminary and then graduate school was a process of moving further and further away from that working class reality. And all of a sudden, I thought back and realized all of the kinds of messages that I had picked up as I was growing up in a medium-sized town in Wisconsin. My father had an eighth grade education, and even though he ended up having his own business as a heating and sheet metal contractor, he definitely did see himself as part of the working class. My mother had been a stenographer for a short time, but they married and really didn't work after that. Quote, didn't work. That's, you know, again, the assumption we make, you know, you work in the home and that somehow not work.
Not gainfully employed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And yet, you know, I was so conscious of the messages I picked up when I was in high school. It was made very clear to me that I was different from the folks who lived about three blocks away and down into what was almost like a pit-type area in town. They clearly were the poor folks. And I also was continually reminded that I did not quite have that much in common with the folks who lived up on East Hill. Those were the sons and the daughters of the doctors and the lawyers. And even though I found myself in accelerated classes in high school with the children of those folks, and therefore they were my peers intellectually, there still was that sense of, well, you know, so-and-so really doesn't want to have that much to do with you. I can remember the very subtle and yet powerful ways in which my mother would communicate those messages to me. And so I was very aware of living, you know, I wasn't poor, and yet I wasn't a part of the kids whose parents were professionals. I was kind of caught in between. What I would like us to do in groups of two or three for the next few minutes is to think back in terms of our own upbringing, whether that was working class, whether you were the son or daughter of professional folks or of poor folks. Try to think back as to messages that you picked up as you were growing up that somehow indicated you were a part of a group that was different from another group, whether it was a group that was below you or a group that was above you.
There's an age factor here going on here.
Okay.
I think people growing up going into grade school after the Civil War ended, mm-hmm. and those who started school prior, mm-hmm. or, you know, Depression years, war, during the war years, I think there's quite a bit, like roughly 1950 might be the demarcation line, maybe it's away from that.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody was poor before the war, but it's a different connotation than today's poor. Nobody had any money, and yet you had some of some values in there with reading and so on. Mm-hmm. When you talk about today's poor, you're probably not. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's do the talking and take into consideration whether this is a real factor that makes a difference. The factor as to whether you were children in the Depression or whatever. But I certainly am talking about working class as something other than just income level or how much money you had available. Just think back and talk with one another for just a few minutes regarding some messages that you got in your upbringing as to something that was either that set you apart from others or something that caused you to have some identity with this group of folks as opposed to that group of folks.
Like that.
I know you've just begun, but I want to tap back into your discussions at this point and have you identify some of the factors that seem to come to the fore, some examples of your becoming aware of some class differences, perhaps, or some of the reasons why you didn't become aware of class differences. Certainly Lois submitted one of those before we broke up. What kinds of things have come up in your discussions?
Well, what I was saying was that when I was raised in England, so I said it was easy to be aware of mm-hmm. class structure. Mm-hmm. It was when I was younger, it was built in
your consciousness.
And I also made the statement that that wasn't all bad. And when I came back, I thought as I was trying to break out of it, it was very restrictive, and it was restrictive. But the result of that, I think, was a reasonably happy society at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It took the changes due to the war to sort of throw things up in the air and cause problems. And I think that it's going to take a while before things settle down to be as pleasant as they were in England. I just returned from there. As I remember them when I was young. Now, this could be a comparison between
childhood.
Yeah, that's right.
Other things that came up.
Yeah, I've just retired from 8 years in a southern medical school, retiring at an early age. And as you describe it, it's exactly the story of the South from the past 50 years. Everything you said could fit exactly in. The class structures are still maybe more present than they are in England. And I disagree entirely, though, with your value judgment of it. I don't think it was pleasant at all then or now, and I think probably England was hurting the way it is. I can only speak for the South, but the pain in the South, someone like Robert Coles talking about interviewing with these people and looking at individual tragedy and seeing the working class, both black and white, there's no great discrimination. There's an enormous impoverishment of this, southern rural areas, regardless of white or black. He just went through and interviewed people in the Appalachians and then interviewed blacks in the plains in the south. And these people were just totally devastated by class structure and still are. Things haven't changed much in the south. In fact, they're markedly regressing social change today. And it's just an overwhelming thing. You're just overwhelmed by being there. You don't have to do a study, but the studies are even more impressive statistically.
It seems as though some of that pain connected with class is even more insidious in societies where class is assumed not to really be a factor, because you don't talk about it. You know, and it was like something hitting me between the eyes when I started reading some of these analyses of working class culture and realizing, hey, yeah, that was all the stuff that didn't get talked about. One of the far more extensive and I think interesting exercises that one can do, and I've done this in some classroom experiences, is to do a class autobiography. This was really the very beginning kind of step, just beginning to talk about some of the things we've been talking about now. But to think back over several generations, if there's some record of who those relatives were, and think, now why is it that I was always told about great-grandma so-and-so, but never said, didn't hear much about my great-grandfather on this other side? And oftentimes it is for class reasons that some folks who, either rebelled against all of that and didn't make much of themselves, quote unquote, or other reasons that they became very invisible in the family tree. You remember their name, but nobody seems to remember too much about what their lives were like and the kind of invisibility that becomes a dynamic that takes over at that point. Other comments from your discussions?
Education was always pushed. You must get a good education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's the way where it makes something out of your life, mm-hmm. is you get a good education. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, I don't think that's a universal either. I think that's a fascinating subject, but the Appalachian people, there's a book called Yesterday's People by a Presbyterian minister written about 45, 50 years ago, so we're not talking about a new subject. And Yesterday's People means that the people of the Appalachians, this obviously doesn't blanket everyone, but his perception of living with these people for about 30 years was that they didn't value education if it meant leaving and going outside of the community. Mm-hmm. My personal experience with some of it was that you couldn't, for instance, get a teaching certificate in the county we lived in for a while unless you went to Appalachian State University, which was the neighboring university. My wife went to Boston University and was unable to get through the politics of getting her teacher certificate in that county because it was the wrong place.
Well, furthermore, there are some very real class differences between what higher education means, whether it's that local community college or the Harvards and the Yales, and we put it all under the umbrella of higher education, and yet there's some very real class differences that operate there, even though certainly some working class kids do go to Harvard and Yale. That's not the predominant kind of route for most working class kids.
There's another one on that, Talia. How long do you think you could put PLU, CLC, St. Olaf, Augustana, Augsburg, and another schools from the University of the State Colleges?
Growing up in basically a working class environment, when I went off to St. Olaf, it was partly the matter of a German and Swede being in a Norwegian setting, the culture shock of that. But far more real was the fact that most of the kids I was going to college with were kids of doctors and professors and the like. And I think there's some very real differences there too.
Well, but even whether to consider education as a realistic point of view, I just finished my internship and I've been all over the country from Oklahoma to Western Pennsylvania and West Virginia. and specifically a lot in Kansas City, Missouri, and Des Moines, Iowa. And you look at the ghetto blacks. I mean, I came from Medford, Oregon, and Marian Anderson was not allowed to stay overnight back in the 40s in Medford, Oregon. That tells you what kind of a town I grew up in, of 25,000 white people. I hardly knew what a black person looked like. So I went off to college, and then I met exchange students from Africa and blacks from Hawaii. Again, you're not talking about the same thing. And then I taught in the Seattle schools and Mercer Island stuff. The blacks I saw, again, were not from the ghetto. Or if they were, they didn't have ghetto values. It's an entirely different ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is no history, often. You have a mother, but you don't have a father. And you don't have talking about great grandpa. You have no idea who great grandpa was, and there's nothing to look forward to. And you don't keep the outside of the house clean, because if you had the outside of the house neat, then somebody would break in. You might keep the inside clean, which is a very surprising revelation to me. I had this child in one of my classes. This was before I was in medical school, who was in the fifth grade and did not read as well as my second grader. And I knew that when he hit junior high, he was going to be a super prop, because he was bouncing off the walls because he couldn't read.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going to the home over the summer and having a summer school program. And his mother brought in, kids and other mothers from the neighborhood and stuff. The home was spotless inside. Looking at it from the outside, you would have thought it would have been the worst stuff you'd ever seen. But that's a real duality. And then some of her kids were very closely linked to the drug culture, which also has a big impact.
I think a number of the responses in the last few minutes have indicated that we're really dealing with a wide diversity. And certainly one of the things I want to say something about are differing responses to working class reality. And so therefore, I don't want you to take what I'm saying in order to create a new stereotype of who working class folks are. But the point of it is to say, how do we get inside that and understand what really is going on and the very differing ways that working class folks might play that out in order to more sympathetically understand that life world. I know that working class reality is very much rooted in the experience of the workplace, and especially a sense of feeling controlled or dominated, whether it's by a big industry or a big business or a government bureaucracy or whatever. And that temptation to, well, the tendency not to talk about the work experience, to think of it as somewhat monotonized and routinized, feeling at times like a machine. What often emerges, according to Sennett and Cobb, is a split self. There's the real self, known only to family and friends, but then there's the work self. And that's not really who I am. And that, I think, becomes a very important defense mechanism in a positive sense, because one is aware of the fact that if I try and gain my dignity according to who I am there in the job, I don't feel like I have much dignity. So that attempt to rescue oneself and say, hey, at least this is who I am, who I can affirm and feel good about. So that pervasive sense of being controlled and trying to survive and struggling to gain some sense of dignity is, I think, the underlying dynamic, which then becomes related to the kinds of responses that are likely to result to that basic experience, responses to that basic experience. Studies in Great Britain, for example, and I do think this in this case it does carry over to responses here in the States, have indicated that there are three kinds of responses to working class reality. One is the proletariat kind of response, the strong sense of being one of the workers, strong sense of being a part of a union, strong sense of a distinction between between us the workers and them the bosses. I don't think that is by any means the predominant working class response in our own day, maybe among some unionized workers. But if we take what I think is much more the definition of working class folks today, namely those who are in blue collar jobs certainly, but also in clerical jobs and a lot of the service sector jobs that are growing at an incredible pace in our society, if one takes those three sectors together, the figures that I came up with doing some research on this in the early 80s is that it's about 70% of the workforce in this country. So working class is not a small little segment, but it's a pretty large segment of those who are workers in our society. So the three responses are, first of all, that proletariat kind of response of, you know, I'm one of the workers, and a class consciousness at that point. A second response is that of deferential workers, D-E-F-E-R, deferential workers. Those who give a lot of allegiance to authority and to hierarchy. They're the workers who are committed to the company, who believe quite firmly in that possibility of upward mobility if only one works hard enough. And I think they are the kind of worker, or this is the kind of working class response that is especially found among those who are in our churches. A third kind of response to working class reality is that of the privatized worker. The privatized worker could care less about the hierarchical structure of the workplace, could care less about any solidarity with other workers, but their main motive in working is what the paycheck makes possible. So it's, I am working in order to do this and that, but I really could care less about the job that I'm doing, and I really don't want anybody to ask me about it. I don't feel any particular allegiance to the company or to the boss, but my main focus is on the consumer goods, the good life that will come out of my working. So those are three responses that some studies in Great Britain have indicated to that is prevalent among working class folks. Another distinction, and this is based on studies that were done in this country, is a distinction between working class folks who are settled livers and those who are hard livers. And I'm not talking about liver as the organ in your body. But the distinction here, and it comes from an author by the name of Joseph Howell, who did a study called Hard Living on Clay Street, where he discovered there were two very different responses. The settled livers were those who had a lot of pride in their neighborhood and in their life, and who basically went along with the way things are and tried to make something of themselves and that sort of thing. Hard livers, in contrast, were those who really rebelled against all of that. And so the stereotype is of the, you know, the guys who are drinking at the tavern every night and who really could care less about things like church and all the rest, but who basically say, oh, to hell with it all, and therefore deal with the reality that they find themselves caught up in with that kind of a response. One of the other studies that that also was originally done in Great Britain is a study of different language codes. And I think this is especially important for those of us that are involved professionally in the church or in education. The distinction that sometimes is made is a distinction on the one hand between restricted code and elaborated codes of communication. What is far more prevalent in the upbringing of working class folks is the use of restricted code. Short, simple, direct, to the point kinds of commands or rules. You do this or else. You know, no reason for why you do this. It's not a matter of, well, you treat Johnny good because, you know, we should treat one another good. But it's, you know, you treat so-and-so this way, that's it. A lot of obedience to rules is emphasized. More of a communal emphasis on we rather than the personal emphasis on I. Things are put in a black or white kind of juxtaposition. If you get pregnant, of course you married the guy who got you pregnant. An emphasis on coping with the present or the immediate future. Long-term kinds of plans of, you know, what I'm going to be doing with my life 10, 20 years from now are not a part of what is tended to be a restricted code of language. The elaborated code of communication, which is certainly the code prevalent in higher education, is far more nuanced. There's a far more formal language structure. Lots of reason. And one can see this in terms of the language and the upbringing of children. My husband and I are very conscious of the fact that we're continually trying to tell Aaron, well, you know, do this because of this and that, and blah, 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 blah. And of course, he continually comes with all his why. And we're always having to come up, well, you do this because of such and such and such and such. Now, if we were stereotypical working class parents in the way in which we're trying to raise our son, we would be more likely to say, well, this is the rule, and that's it. And you don't quite, yeah, because I said it. And it's my status and my role as your mother that gives that authority. Now, again, these are not hard and fast kinds of distinctions. I think those of us who've been through the, who don't see ourselves operating out of working class kinds of things, at times, you know, this is the rule, and I'm going to make sure that it gets enforced. So again, these are distinctions for the purpose of discussion, even though in real life it's a bit more nuanced than what I'm laying out here. So in the elaborated code that tends to be far more prevalent among those who are middle, upper middle class, etc., language is more reflexive, and therefore people, as they use language, develop a more reflexive relationship with their social order. The way things are out there is seen as a bit more changeable. I'm a historical agent. I can have an effect on my world, and that occurs to a greater degree than for a lot of working class folks and the kind of language patterns that they're used to. A fellow who does a lot of editing of adult ed material, adult education material for the LCA, shared with me a study he had done. He was really bugged by the fact that he would continually get these letters from local parishioners saying, well, we'd really like to use your material, but we can't understand the language you use. And he did a study and realized that the church kind of language tends to use a lot of the big Latinized kinds of phrases. And that is not necessarily that similar to the really gutsy Anglo-Saxon kinds of expressions that is far more prevalent in working class culture. The Latinization words being a lot of the T-I-O-N kinds of words and the, you know, the highfalutin sounding language. And therefore, there have been studies done to indicate working class folks have that acute awareness of having other folks using language they don't quite connect with. And if any of you are thoroughly working class here, you're probably aware that I'm doing exactly that in this discussion, namely using some quote highfalutin words in order to understand what is going on. Let me just mention some other things, and then I want us to have a little bit of time to process and ask more questions about this. I think there is a very determined quest for freedom on the part of working class folks. So I would say, yeah, there's a lot of pathos, there's a lot of hidden wounds of class that operate, but there's also a lot of determination, a lot of joy, there's a lot of, you know, it's not just a bleak kind of picture. And I think that joy and where meaning is really found is in what is especially the sacred turf for working class folks, namely the home and the family. The home is the source of one's pride, the expression of one's real identity, and it's really seen as an island of freedom in a world of control by others. And the big investments are carefully protected, you know, whether it's the velvet couch with the plastic over it or the big TV, which is more often than not likely to be the center of the home, although that's probably true for many of our homes, whether we're working class or not. And family is all important. Kinship patterns are considered more important. One doesn't move away from one's family unless it becomes absolutely necessary financially. If there's no longer any jobs available in that community, for example. The home is typically where the man feels in control, and so I think there are some very real ways in which class and patriarchy get reinforced again and again in our society. As one father said regarding his grown son, "This is my house. He has the option to go and live on his own if he wants, but as long as he's under my roof, he has to abide by my rules." So the man's wife and children are more likely to be perceived as, you know, as his property, the objects of his control and manipulation. And therefore, I don't think it's that surprising that workplace frustration, when brought home, often results in domestic violence. And I'm not saying just for working class folks, but, you know, for the whole gamut. Frustration in the workplace and the kind of ways in which that gets taken out on one's wife or one's children. I think there's a lot of stuff there that needs to be explored. Working class women have been found to value husbands who are steady workers, who don't drink too much, and who don't hit their wives. And even if one is no longer working class, it's interesting to think back, what parental messages did you pick up if you came from basically a working class family as to what a good spouse would be like? And my mother's always reminding me, well, you know, you should have married somebody like this and that, somebody who could fix this and that, and all of these messages. Emotional values of intimacy, sharing, and communication are not as important as they would be for some upper middle class folks. If a working class woman works outside the home, her authority in a marriage tends to increase, much to the chagrin of her husband. However, such a woman's entry into the job market has usually not been due to choice, but to economic necessity, especially as her husband experiences downward mobility or unemployment, or increasingly because she no longer has a husband. Now, what is also interesting is the degree to which equipping the kids for upward mobility is an important kind of tenet in working class culture. And yet, the typical child-rearing values of working class folks are those which condition the kids to become more like their parents. Conformity to external standards or authorities is emphasized, in contrast to an emphasis on self-direction and critical questioning, which is more a part of the culture of upper-middle class folks. Constraint is important in maintaining order and obedience. Knowing that something is wrong is considered far more important than knowing why it is wrong. This goes back to the restricted versus elaborated language codes. An emphasis on external conformity is crucial for preparing working class children for jobs in which conformity to rules and authority will be necessary. The implicit assumption is that conformity to external authority will enable the children to move upward, but the parents' own experience, as well as some recent developments in the economics of our country, namely that more and more jobs are in the secondary labor market and not the jobs of upward mobility, cast doubt on the likelihood of that upwardly mobile outcome. So there's ambivalence in what working class folks want their children to become. Parents see their own lives serving not as an example, but as a warning to their kids. Don't become like me. Better yourself. Now, I'm quite aware of the fact that my father was taking out U.S. savings bonds for my college education when I was a month old. He was determined that I would, quote, make something of myself. My mother continually says, well, if he were still alive, he probably didn't have any notion that becoming a clergy person or a seminary professor is what he wants you to become. But anyway, that's another story. So working class parents are determined that their children will be different from themselves. Consequently, they do what alone is in their power. They sacrifice for them. The sacrifice is one of the few expressions of freedom and control available to working folks. It provides them with a sense of the future. At least my kids will make it into the American dream. But the difficulty is that the dream, that sacrifice, in a sense, gets betrayed, because as the children do get the higher education, either they move in their life world away from their folks, so that I will go home now, my mother will say, well, yeah, but I didn't quite, you know, I can no longer, I don't have the same interest she does. You know, I'll talk about what I'm doing, and it's kind of this, there's this big gap, because it doesn't make sense in terms of her life world. Not only might the children move away in terms of the life world and the values that they develop, but they also move away physically. So it's a matter of moving away physically and psychologically. And then all of a sudden, that kind of emptiness that a parent can feel when, gee, I tried to make this possible for my kid to make it, but no longer does it feel as if my kids have redeemed the sacrifice that I had made for them. And I'm purposely using some religious language here, because I think what we're talking about is a very real spiritual crisis provoked in no small part by the dynamics of a class society. And I think, therefore, one of the important kinds of things we need to be about, and especially in the church, because in the church we talk about we're all one in Christ, and we repeat all of that, without realizing how subtly we too get caught up in perpetuating those differences of class. We need to be aware of that, and then to say, okay, how can working class folks begin to see themselves as more empowered subjects of their world? That I see as an important kind of pastoral, theological agenda that the church needs to take far more seriously. But it needs to begin by lots of us trying to think through more sympathetically why it is that working class culture is the way it is, rather than just kind of standing on the side and poo-pooing and saying, oh, well, you know, there's the Archie Bunker types, etc. Some of that may be helpful to begin to understand, but I think we need to get beyond that in order to uncover some of the pain that really is there and that people have been conditioned to cover over and not talk about. How can the church become a place where we can talk about some of that stuff that we have imbibed in this society? Okay, let me stop for a moment.
One thing I wonder about is are we doing anyone a favor to encourage people to think that they can take control of their own lives and control over their environment when the economic situation and the political situation is such that they can't?
Right. I don't think that the kind of individual kind of control, you know, I'm going to turn things around. I think there's a real bankruptcy in that kind of promise. I think, though, if we talk about folks connecting up with one another, And all of a sudden, the blue-collar worker and the clerical worker and some other folks begin to discover there are some common dynamics that they're experiencing. Now, obviously, what I'm pointing to then is a rather long kind of agenda, because there's so little class consciousness generally in American society. But I think the church is one of the key institutions in society where people can begin to share some of that experience and utter that which basically hasn't been spoken, and to discover a kind of communal praxis to begin to ask some basic questions about the way in which things are structured. And so I do not see it as an individual trying to take control and trying to make it. Because, you know, we can always find success stories of working class folks for whom that's worked, but then there's the whole mass of working class folks for whom that has not been the case.
I think maybe it's, again, unique to Minnesota, but the metropolitan area, Twin Cities, and then up north, this focus is up north, is anything north, you know, an hour north of Twin Cities, the Lakes area. So many people, this is their escape. Friday night, you're off up to the lake, and you come back late Sunday night. And you know, here you have something other than your workday world. And the majority, and I shouldn't say majority, awful lot of people who we would call blue-collar, working class, unionized, so on, or non-unionized, they have made this investment up north. And you know, that's a place where they can be them, and it's you know, there they have control of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you tell me they'll come and all that, but you know, but that's a phenomenon that I assume, you know, I assume there's something in Wisconsin the same.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, we have that same phenomenon. Except my father, like many working class fathers, you know, worked almost 7 days a week, so
yeah,
getting up
right
there to enjoy it was
right
more of a myth than a reality.
But
at
when
times
you've got the 5 day a week, you know, as much as it is now, the mm-hmm plants is on. And that's that Friday night, I was just a kid, I had been taken right back from northwest of the cities on Friday evening. And I had constant traffic that I met all the way out, 189 miles of constant traffic to the north.
I know that I've already spoken, but just briefly, there's so many things that are reversing the direction of things. Most of this, a large percentage of people now are downloading mobile rather than talking to mobile. People are not saving for college and university to the extent they used to. They're consuming rather than saving. There's all these various things that are going on, which in many ways it seems to be that our experience and our parents' experience is not going to be anywhere near the experience of our children.
Right, and yet, see, the real problem is that the promise still lingers on there somehow.
I mean, it's
and the gap between the promise.
It gets worse when you can't fulfill the promise.
Yeah, yeah. And therefore, the disillusionment, all the kinds of crises that emerge because of the fact that it doesn't quite work the way we've been told it would, or the way we were conditioned to have it